Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are many historians, of course. There are some who are expert in this phenomenon I call the war for the free world. There are some whom have written serially on the subject of the conflicts and the principles, most especially my favorite, Ronald Reagan. But there are very few who have all of these qualities and who have done it as well and as, well, as often as our guest for this full memorial hour marking the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor than our guest, Craig Shirley. Craig is the author of, as you can tell, many books, including one that is particularly relevant to the present topic, December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World. We'll talk about it now, and we'll talk in due course about his several books on Ronald Reagan. But first, let me welcome properly Craig Shirley to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us, Craig.
You bet, Frank. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm really grateful to you. I know how busy you are at a moment like this when many people are clamoring for your insights about this remarkable day, which really did change, as you say, change America and the world. One of the things that I'm struck by, and obviously it's been a subject of endless controversy and discussion, Craig, is that, as is so often the case, in hindsight, it seems there was plenty of evidence that Imperial Japan was going to attack somewhere, and quite likely it was going to attack American assets. Give us your read on what was known at the time, and particularly this very interesting intelligence document your son stumbled upon in Pennsylvania, as I recall.
Yes, the Hyde Park in upstate New York he found. I think we have to go back to Matthew Perry first sailing into Tokyo Harbor in the 1850s. Japan had been basically a closed society for three centuries. They sent people away, and Matthew Perry sails in. And it begins a long and warm relationship between Japan and the United States. It wasn't the open-door policy, but it was an open-door policy. And soon, trade and cultural exchanges and educational exchanges flourished between Japan and the United States, and Japan was on our side in the Great War. And in 1905, Teddy Roosevelt, of course, won the Nobel Prize for negotiating the end of the Sino-Japanese War at Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And the Japanese always felt that Teddy Roosevelt held a special place in their hearts because they always felt like Roosevelt had bent over backwards to hear their side, to hear them out as far as their point of view in the war with Russia. So there'd always been good relations. As the two countries began to diverge at the end of World War One, a shogunate culture started to take root in Japan. It was basically racist. It was anti-white. It was anti-West. It was anti-Western influence. And they began to shut down U.S. Trade, U.S. exchanges, and became very isolationist. But we, in turn, also passed legislation that restricted immigration from Asiatic countries and things like that. So we were going divergent. By the 1930s, we're, of course, passing neutrality acts, which included, for instance, banning U.S. troops from leaving North America. And the Japanese are becoming increasingly militaristic and increasingly hostile. But as they build their military-industrial complex, Japan has no natural resources. It's a giant rock in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It has no precious metals. It has no oil. It has no iron ore. It has nothing. So they, to, in order to feed their growing military needs, they need to basically, you know, steal it from other countries in the Western Pacific. And they do so. They invade Manchuria in 1937. They invade Malaya. They have designs on other countries, Indochina, the Philippines eventually. And so we are, of course, becoming increasingly concerned about their militaristic ways. And we lay down, we make offers. We offer peace offerings and things like that, which are completely rejected. By the time of November and the first week of December 1941, we have broken their diplomatic codes, which are being transmitted between Tokyo and the Washington Embassy. We've also, the Office of Naval Intelligence has conducted extensive investigations of the Japanese consulates in the United States, of which there are many. There are consulates in New Orleans and San Francisco and Los Angeles and Miami and Boston, and of course the embassy here in Washington, and they're all basically operating full-time. And of course there's one in curiously in Honolulu, overlooking the U.S. Fleet there at in Oahu in Pearl Harbor Bay. So they're all operating basically as full-time spy operations, gathering whatever information they can and transmitting it in various fashions back to Japan. You know, some of it's just sent by regular old mail. Some of it's sent by telegram. Some of it's sent by shortwave radio. There's other forms of communication, but they're all, vast spy networks to determine America's willingness for war, America's preparation for war, America's determination for war, everything to, and so finally by...
Do tell us, before we run out of time on this block, Craig Shirley, about the 4th of December 1941 Rosetta Stone, as you call it, fascinating document.
It's a 25-page document. Yes, I'm sorry, I'm prattling on. The 25-page document produced by the Office of Naval Intelligence, which was delivered to the White House on December 4th, 1941, contained vast and revealing information about Japanese military intentions on various targets in the Central and Western Pacific, including the Panama Canal, including the Philippines, including other Guam, Midway, Wake Island, and, of course, the island of Oahu and the Hawaiian Islands. And so this is all, you know, basically a roadmap without a date. We believe, according to this memo, that the Japanese are going to attack. They're going to attack somewhere. It could be the Philippines. It could be someplace. But we don't know where. And we don't know what date. But nonetheless, none of this information is given to Admiral Husband E. Kimmel, who was the CINCPAC commander in the Pacific, had, of course, the command of the U.S. fleet there, or to General Walter Short, who was the head of the Army garrison, again, on Hawaii. None of this, not the diplomatic codes, not the ONI memo, nothing is given them so they can formulate their own opinions.
Do we know, Craig Shirley, with confidence whether Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president of the United States, saw this Rosetta Stone memo of December 4th?
That's a great question. The answer is we don't know, and there's no way of knowing. We can presume, since it was at Hyde Park at FDR Library and was delivered, was a specially tailored memo for the White House, marked top secret, confidential to the White House. And of course, he had an inbox. You know, he was famous for his inbox in the Oval Office and in the Red Room of the White House.
And this really was a moment when his attention was clearly very focused on this. In fact, as I recall, he shortly thereafter said when he learned that the Japanese had broken off negotiations that this is war. So it was uppermost on his mind.
Right. And he said that after inspecting the broken diplomatic codes that are being transmitted to the embassy there in Washington. He knows, and that's when he said, yes, you're exactly right. He said, this means war. So presumably, if he was seeing that information, he was also seeing the information from Office of Naval Intelligence.
Craig, we're going to pause here for a moment. When we come back, I want to just sort of round this up and then look a little beyond Pearl Harbor to what flowed from it. But I do want to get at this question of what did FDR know and when did he know it, as best we can ascertain it, and whether Admiral Kimmel and General Short were made the whipping boys, really, for a degree of, malfeasance, perhaps elsewhere in the chain of command. That and more with Craig Shirley, world-class historian, best-selling author, and great American, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Our guest is Craig Shirley, a friend of many years who is one of the great chroniclers of our time, particularly the part of that time shaped dramatically by his old boss and mine, Ronald Reagan. We'll be talking about that in detail here momentarily, but we're talking with Craig about another subject of great interest to him, the subject indeed of one of his terrific books, December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World. An event that features prominently in the book, of course, is Pearl Harbor, the attack thereon. And it occurred 75 years ago to this very day. And Craig is very gracious to join us to talk a bit about it. And Craig, you were discussing how information was in the hands of the FDR White House. A little unclear exactly what he had seen, in particular in connection with this Office of Naval Intelligence memo of December 4th. But as a serious student of the subject, Craig, where do you come down on the question that is often bruited about, particularly on the internet, that he actually knew that an attack was coming at Pearl Harbor and he declined to do anything about it because he wanted to bring the United States into a war he knew we must fight? What are your thoughts?
I would love to put this to rest once and for all. Despite, political differences, I believe that FDR was a patriot. I believe he loved the country. I believed he took his oath to defend the Constitution seriously. And not only that is that there's no evidence, there's no diaries, there's no reports, there's no nothing that he knew about the attack. And he was, all reports are, he was just as shocked as everybody when he got the news as he was having lunch with his staff on December 7, 1941. He was just as appalled and was just as angry, that airplanes were on the ground, wingtip to wingtip, being blown up, in the smithereens. And more to the point, Frank, is that there is no linkage between our entry into the Pacific War with our entry into the European War. Fully 4 days passes between December 7th and December 11th. At no time is there any call whatsoever. Once we declare war on Japan, there's not an editorial, there's not a congressional comment, there's not a comment from the White House, from FDR, from Henry Wallace, from anybody in the cabinet saying, well, now that we're in the Pacific War, we have to get in the European War. There's not one shred of evidence.
Craig Shirley is visiting with us about World War II, its opening moments and Pearl Harbor Day 75 years ago this very day. And Craig, you were just making the point that the thesis that many have, given currency, that FDR wanted to get the United States into the European War and saw an attack by the Japanese as a pretext for doing so, just doesn't actually compute, because in fact he was surprised, you believe, and not only that, but he didn't immediately launch a war against the Nazis, but they did against us in due course.
Yes, they did on the 11th, and of course we had to respond in kind since Germany and Italy had signed the Tripartite Pact with Japan, which required a mutual defense, but there also is another piece of evidence, which is very important, Frank, is that in going through Henry Stimson's papers, of course, Henry Stimson was Secretary of War under Franklin Roosevelt in December of 1941. Going through the Stimson papers at Yale, there was a draft, early draft of FDR's asking for Congress for the Day of Infamy speech, which everybody knows it by. And in the draft, he asked for a declaration of war against Japan, Germany, and Italy, and then through Germany and Italy, a pencil line is drawn clearly, because Roosevelt had convened his war council the afternoon and the evening of December 7th. Clearly, you know, his cabinet, vice president, the Navy, you know, Knox, Stark, everybody, it had been discussed. Clearly, it had been, we're going to go to war with Japan. Let's just do the whole thing right now. Clearly, it had been discussed, but it had been determined not to declare war on Germany and Italy, because there was no will in this country for going to war with Italy and Germany. So the pencil line is drawn through, so we just declare war on Japan.
Craig Shirley, let me ask you about one other piece of this 25-page memo, which you cite recently, and I was really struck by it because there's, of course, such, well, guilt, I guess is the best way to describe it, for the internment of Japanese citizens, American citizens, but of Japanese extraction in most cases, who were resident in the United States after Pearl Harbor. One of the data points that jumped out at me was the statistics about the number of Japanese-related individuals in the population of Hawaii on the eve of Pearl Harbor. Talk a little bit about that and how concerns about their potential, well, involvement with Japanese-only organizations might conduce to real security threats for our country.
It was a grave concern, so much so that General Walter Short, is more worried about sabotage of his Army planes or Army Air Force planes than he is of an aerial bombardment. So he has the planes put out in the middle of Hickam Field, parked wingtip to wingtip, so they can be guarded against sabotage. And of course, this made for, you know, easy targets for the Japanese attack of December 7, 1941. If you hit one airplane, you hit basically all of them because they're wingtip to wingtip. But there was something like in Oahu at the time, there was something like six Japanese civilians for every one American. So there was real grave concern of Japanese sabotage and espionage in the Hawaiian Islands in December of 1941.
Which ultimately led to many being interned after the attack. Craig, just quickly, give us as a historian sort of the lessons of Pearl Harbor as you see it that are still with us, or perhaps being less and less learned these days, but that we should be keeping in mind. I'm thinking particularly of a phrase that our old boss Ronald Reagan coined and practiced: peace through strength.
Yes, and we didn't communicate that. You know, we had come in October of 1941. We had come within one boat in the house of disbanding the U.S. Army, completely disarming the U.S. Army. But even then, our planes were old and tired. Our ships were old and tired. Our army was old and tired. We were not projecting strength at all. Part of our isolationism included a broad streak of pacifism in the teens and 20s and 30s in America. And so we weren't, you know, devoting any of our budget whatsoever to our military capability, which of course we paid for woefully in the Philippines, at Wake Island, at Guam, at Palmyra, and of course at Hawaii, because we were so weak. So I think the lesson obviously is peace through strength, trust but verify, as our old boss Reagan also used to say, and that the world is a dangerous, dangerous place, and that people lie, and that countries lie, and diplomats lie. So that you listen to them, you talk to them, you negotiate with them, but you never ever trust them.
Yeah, and I guess a corollary, Craig, as I know you know from both the Reagan years and your study of history before and since, is that the cost of deterrence is cheap compared to the cost of fighting the wars that are brought on when deterrence is either non-existent or simply inadequate. And I just am reminded of that at a moment when we're seeing a very dangerous world once again upon us, a new president coming to office with the challenge that, well, not terribly unlike that Ronald Reagan faced. And we're going to talk a little bit in the course of the next segment or two with Craig Shirley about Reagan's response to that challenge, his decisive years leading up to his presidency and, of course, the presidency itself and its legacy. All of that and more with Craig Shirley, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest is Craig Shirley, who has generously given us a full hour of his time to talk about several topics of particular importance. We've been discussing on this 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor, that terrifically consequential attack and what flowed from it. We're turning now to another area of great expertise and the subject of several important books by Craig Shirley, the Reagan Revolution. How it came about, the election that brought him to power, and what he did with the mandate that he achieved. And, Craig, I was just running out of proposition before the break, and I'd ask you to respond to it, that there is a certain similarity between the kind of international strategic, if you will, environment that that Reagan confronted when he came to office, somewhat similar, one might argue, to the period we had seen before World War II as well, where we had neglected our defenses, we had disengaged somewhat from the world, we had invited aggression by enemies. Do you see a parallel to our own time?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Evil always rushes in to take advantage of weakness and disunity and indecision, Frank. The Japanese did, the Soviets did, and now radical Islam is doing the same thing. Is that we were not united in December 1941. We were not united in 1979. And in many ways, we're not united now. Is that there's very different opinions on how to deal with radical Islam. And so, and it requires a strong leader, with a clear vision and a clear way of articulating it. I don't think in FDR's defense, I think it was a failure of imagination. And you have to go back to 1941. It's just that people just didn't imagine or believe that the Japanese had the capacity. You know, it wasn't like today where you could, look at Google Map and look at the Japanese Navy. It just, it was thousands of miles away, and their military secrets were just that, secrets. But nobody could imagine they could move six carriers and dozens of escorts and thousands, 300, 400 planes and thousands of men, 4,000 miles at flank speed through open North Pacific waters and never be detected, and then launch a successful attack. But Roosevelt did respond aggressively. But Reagan learned from Roosevelt's experience not to be weak before you're strong. I think Obama has failed the lessons of history, which is, of course, what we've always been taught is that those who fail to study history are doomed to repeat it. And hopefully Trump will avert, will not make the same mistakes that Obama has in the face of radical Islam.
Yeah, as you're saying that, Craig, this is the continuum, the arc of history, if you will, that I call the war for the free world, because it does seem as though time after time, Reagan used to discuss this in terms of every generation having to fight an existential threat to freedom. And you've just described the several very, very well. As you look at Reagan's time, talk a little bit, if you would, about what shaped him. I know you've got a new book coming out in March about his decisive years, the 4 years leading up to his election. But what as you studied his character, his upbringing, his time, in the radio business, the Screen Actors Guild, and so on, what made this man the man who ultimately became arguably our greatest president?
Such a great question. And every time I'm asked it, I have trouble answering it because he took so much information from so many sources. One thing I will tell you is that illustrates when he and his brother Neil were boys, they once asked their father how much he made. And Jack Reagan, actually became angry with his sons. And he said, that is something you don't ask any man. That is none of your business. You never ask anybody how. And it gave Reagan a strong sense of the concept of individual privacy and dignity, which are at the heart of American conservatism. So, and of course, his parents, you know, their Christian upbringing, his father's Catholicism was infused in Reagan. Reagan talked like a Catholic. He didn't talk like a Protestant. You know, he said we, us, and ours instead of me, I, me, and my. His days in Hollywood, when it was his tax policy was paying up to 90-95% was going to the government, really, you know, angered him. When he was in college, he had a professor who told him that Smoot-Hawley, which as we know was the restrictive tariff and trade bill passed by two Republicans and signed into law by Herbert Hoover, did a lot to lead to the Great Depression. So he was always a free trader after that. He wasn't for stupid trade. He was for fair trade, but he was also for free trade because he believed that it bound the politics of the West together to meet the Soviet challenge. But the communist agents who tried to infiltrate various Hollywood trade unions, that fueled his anti-communism. When he was governor, he saw the corruption of the left and the Democrats in Sacramento, and said that also made him realize that concentrations of power inevitably lead to corruption and diminution of personal freedom. So by the time he runs in 1976 and 1980, he is a fully formed American conservative. And I say American conservative quite deliberately because we are different from British or European conservatism. We believe in our country, which is unique in the world, is that power flows up from the people to the government, whereas, say, in the British system, they believe that power flows downward from the government and the culture and the society to the individual. So, you know, it's quite unique, but it's also dangerous too because it allows for maximum freedom.
Let me ask you about one piece of this personal trajectory that I've always been struck by. It's captured in another wonderful book about Reagan in his own words that I think really brings home the measure of this man that, as you know so well, Craig Shirley, his time on the General Electric speaking circuit and his various commentaries and published works and so on, all written by him, as I understand it, in his own hand and speaking to the kind of, well, intellectual rigor and self-discipline and, to some extent, self-education that was, of course, completely ignored, in fact, ridiculed by the likes of Clark Clifford, who called him an amiable dunce.
Yeah, well, it turns out Clark Clifford was actually an amiable crook, but that's for
among
that's
other
another
things.
Time.
Yeah.
Yes, and among other things. Reagan was an autodidact. He was always learning. He was always evolving. You know, most men reach a point in their lives in the 30s and 40s where they adopt a set view of the world, and that becomes their compass for the rest of their lives. Reagan was learning and evolving even in his 50s and 60s, becoming more refined, more reflective. And part of that was, I mean, he got a great education at Eureka. He always appreciated that. But when he was traveling, as you correctly had pointed out, for GE in the 50s, you know, he was traveling all over the country, going to speak at plants in Syracuse and Boston and Rochester, Minnesota. He would get on the train because at the time he refused to fly. So he only traveled by car, by train. And he wouldn't go to the club car and knock back drinks and make passes at women like the other businessmen. He would get a stateroom, and he would lock himself in the stateroom with a steamer trunk full of books and magazines. And he would sit there for hours on end reading these books and reading these magazine articles so that he was continuing his own education. So that this was always a man who was always learning new things, learning, looking at things in a different way. As opposed to, you know, other politicians of the era.
Craig, you know, there's so much to talk about in the Reagan years. The part that I particularly would like to focus with you on, given the topic of this program, and I think the interest of the audience, is, of course, Reagan's legacy in the national security arena. And we have to pause for a moment, but when we come back, I want to talk with you about the strategy that Reagan adopted to destroy that totalitarian ideology that sought the destruction of the United States at the time, Soviet communism, codified, I think, most articulately in National Security Decision Directive 75. And to discuss in particular its potential relevance as a template for how we deal with today's existential threat to freedom, the jihad, the global jihad movement. That and much more with Craig Shirley, author of Reagan's Revolution, the untold story of the campaign that started it all, and Last Act, the final years and emerging legacy of Ronald Reagan. That and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We're talking with well, arguably the preeminent Reagan biographer. He is Craig Shirley, and he spent time in the Reagan administration. He has chronicled many aspects of Reagan's life before, during, and after his government service. He is the author, in addition, of an important book we discussed early on about Pearl Harbor and the events of that month in December 1941, 75 years ago, that changed our world. But we're talking now about how Reagan changed our world with respect to his time's existential threat to freedom. And by that, I mean the time when he was in the presidency, namely Soviet communism. And Craig Shirley, in 1983, Ronald Reagan penned a secret memorandum known as National Security Decision Directive 75. That essentially directed all instruments of national power against the Soviet communists to try to bring about their defeat, something he famously described as his strategy, we win, they lose. Share with us a little bit the importance of the thinking that went into that and what came out of it.
What Reagan believed that America operated on a higher moral plane than any other country in history. And he approached the presidency in that fashion. He was a romantic. He did see the world in absolutes, and he believed the United States was good and the Soviet Union was evil. And I think there's a lot of evidence to illustrate that was, in fact, the case. But he, you know, when he left office in January 1989, he cited some of his accomplishments. He kind of stuck out his chest, and he said that one of the most things that I'm most proud of is the restoration of Americans' morale. Reagan understood that a happy people are a productive people, and all through the 60s and 70s, the American people were unhappy. And the more unhappy they became, the more despondent they became, the less productive they became, the more inflation took hold, high interest rates, the less we believed that in American exceptionalism or that we could solve the ills of our society and the world society. And the left famously played on these fears, as did Jimmy Carter, culminating with his infamous malaise speech in 1979. So emerges in 1980s is that two distinct, not just ideologies or philosophies, but two different views of the world. One view says we can do nothing to change the world, and the other side says we can do everything and we must do everything to change the world. And Reagan approaches his own presidency in that fashion. So he knows that a productive people produce war material and goods and services that can be used to defeat Soviet communism. He used everything. He told Radio Free Europe, he said, turn up the dials full blast. I want my speeches and my commentaries heard all through Eastern Europe and all through the Soviet republics. And they did. So he was hitting them economically. He was hitting them in terms of trade. He was hitting them in terms of the bully pulpit. He was hitting them in terms of military, with the building up of our military. He believed that if he hit the Soviets with everything, that eventually they would give up the ghost and collapse because the Soviet economy just simply couldn't keep up with the American economy. And, of course, he was proven right.
And he had a remarkable cadre of people around him. I'm thinking of Bill Clark and Cap Weinberger and Dick Gallen and William Casey and Gene Kirkpatrick, Ed Meese. I mean, really remarkable people who made, this presidency all that
it could
be. But
that's such an important point, Frank, because you cannot think of a great man without thinking of the great people around him. You can't think of George Washington without thinking of the great people around him, whether it's Benjamin Franklin or Hamilton or Jefferson. You can't think of Abraham Lincoln without thinking of the great men around him, whether it's John Hay or Ulysses Grant or other field commanders. or Seward, some of his cabinet. You can't think about Franklin Roosevelt without thinking about Stimson and Cordell Hull and Douglas MacArthur and George Marshall and Patton and others. Is that and Eisenhower had great men around him, certainly John Foster Dulles. So that great men attract great men, and Reagan proved that adage.
We're perfectly situated here to segue to another man, potentially great, we hope, the incoming president of the United States, now actively bringing around him men and women, some of whom he's identified already, some of whom are about to be in the days ahead. I'm very interested, Craig Shirley, as you look at the Trump administration so far, how would you grade what we are seeing in terms of the clarity of its vision, the caliber of the talent being drawn upon, and the necessity for the same kind of rising through peace, through strength, among other things, to existential challenges of our time?
I think that Donald Trump might be the cleverest man, the cleverest politician in a generation. It's interesting because he wants to drain the swamp. He wants to reconfigure Washington. He wants to reduce its power and influence. Do you do that with naive outsiders? Jimmy Carter tried that. Jimmy Carter came to Washington with the best of intentions, which was to reform the government and shrink government and reorganize it and middle-class tax cuts. And he got lost in power, as Bill Buckley would say. Partially in part because he filled his cabinet with either hacks or neophytes who didn't know what they were doing. You know, Bert Lance and other people like that who were just in over their heads. I think that Trump is being very wise. I don't think you can reorganize the bureaucracy or shrink the bureaucracy or in some cases destroy the bureaucracy without having men who really understand the bureaucracy. And I think he's being very wise in that regard because, A, they'll pass muster easily as far as Senate confirmation. B is that they've already been vetted because they've already been, you know, had various, posts in business and government. So that presumably, you know, you're not going to get bogged down in a long protracted nomination fight. And C is that he's the president. He sets the theme. He sets the tone. He sets the direction for his administration. So these people are then going to go out and do what he wants them to do, including pushing back on ISIS, fighting ISIS, defeating ISIS. I like the fact that he just canceled the Boeing contract. I thought that was a great thing to do. You know, obviously Boeing was just ripping off billions of dollars in this airplane, and it was just the kind of strong, decisive action that I think Americans are hungering for right now.
Yeah, you know, speaking of the bureaucracy, Craig Shirley, as a serious student of what Ronald Reagan accomplished, I'm struck by, in particular, the challenge that he faced. I remember it very vividly from my vantage point in the Defense Department at the time.
Yeah, you were there.
With the State Department. One of the great anecdotes about all this, as I know you are aware, is of course his effort to say what he thought needed to be said at the Brandenburg Gate to Mikhail Gorbachev, and the determined effort by the State Department bureaucracy to prevent him from doing it. Recount that story quickly, if you would.
Yeah, sure. But this played out in Reagan's life in the 1980 campaign. You remember he was giving a speech to the veterans of foreign war, and he wanted to go before them, and he wanted to call the Vietnam War a noble cause. And this just caused heart palpitations and the vapors among the moderates around his campaign, the elites around the campaign, David Gergen and others. So they kept taking that line out. And, you know, Reagan would add it back in. They'd take it out. Reagan would add it back in. They'd take it out. Finally, he gives a speech and he calls the Vietnam War a noble cause. And the American people loved it. The elites hated it. The American people loved it because, for once, somebody was actually paying tribute to the Vietnam War. And maybe we lost, but it wasn't for lack of national will or for righteousness on our side. And so the American people just ate it up. This played out again, as it did many times. Reagan was a person you could talk with, you could reason with, you could cajole Reagan, but you couldn't push Reagan because he'd push right back.
We're going to pause for one last break. We'll be right back with a last segment with Craig Shirley right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Our guest is Craig Shirley. We have been imposing upon him for this full hour to talk about, oh, so many aspects of recent American history, particularly that shaped during World War II and by President Reagan during the Cold War, and that is about to be shaped now by Donald Trump. The arc of history, if you will, the war for the free world, as I call it, the challenges we face domestically as well as externally. And I wanted to just draw you out, if I could, Craig, in our final segment here about, well, crystal ball gazing, I guess, if you will, but looking forward, if you were counseling Donald Trump about how to have a presidency, ideally as consequential as Ronald Reagan's, it's starting perhaps with this phone call that took place last week with the president of Taiwan. Ronald Reagan was very committed to Taiwan, as you know, and very much opposed to communism in all of its forms, including that of communist China and the threat that it posed to Taiwan. But talk a little bit about what Donald Trump has done even before he becomes president and what it might mean going forward.
You know, John Kennedy once asked Clare Booth Luce almost that exact question. And she told him, she said, be less Harvard and more Irish, which I thought was just great advice. And I would say to Donald Trump is that be less government and more campaign. In other words, is that govern the way you campaign, which is to shock the establishment, upset the establishment, threaten the establishment, but don't become the establishment. Always be the outsider. You know, you were there. I was there. Reagan was head of the national government for 8 years, and yet nobody ever thought he was a part of Washington. We never saw him as through that prism as being a part of Washington. He was always the outsider, and he was always challenging conventional wisdom, whether it's the defeat of Soviet communism, whether it was tax cuts. He never accepted conventional wisdom. And I would say to Trump, I said, keep your enemies on their heels by never accepting the premise of their argument, but always reframing the debate to your advantage and stay on permanent offense. That's what I would say.
As a case in point, do you see what he did by simply having a conversation with the president of Taiwan as an example?
Completely against
of
conventional wisdom. The one China policy has dominated American foreign policy since Jimmy Carter terribly, awfully, miserably, cowardly abrogated their mutual defense treaty with Taiwan in 1979, one of the great acts of cowardice in the 20th century. You know, the legitimate government of China is not on China, it's on Taiwan. But Reagan knew this, and that's why Reagan set out his own 8 points for Taiwanese recognition in 1982. But I've always thought the one China policy was an immoral compromise with a very bad country. You know, why should they dictate our foreign policy and who we should talk to? I thought it was when I heard that Trump did it. I don't drink, but I would have drank at a toast to Donald Trump for making this phone call, because it sends a message to the Red Chinese. And there's nothing calling them the Red Chinese. You know, they are communists. Is that no longer are they going to dictate American foreign policy? I thought it was a great shot across the bow. It was a beautiful Trump play.
I know. I call it the shot across the bow heard round the world. You know, it really captures that image. But, you know, one of the things that, again, going back to the Reagan years, and you mentioned or alluded to it a moment ago, Strategic Defense Initiative, Craig Shirley, the same kind of histrionics that we heard then when Reagan announced that he was going to look at, I mean, for crying out loud, not abrogate the anti-ballistic missile treaty, but just look at whether it would, in fact, be better to defend the American people than to avenge them. And you see the similar kind kind of, hysteria is the only way to describe it, now among the elites. And I just wonder, when he gainsaid the orthodoxy, when he brought common sense to bear, Reagan clearly showed that you can shake things up and create opportunities for a very different outcome than you'd been living with and told you it was unalterable. A similar thing happening now, do you think?
I think certainly with Carrier, which is a new way of looking at capitalism. I think that you can. It is. You know, it's interesting because you've got some conservatives, constructionists, economic constructionists who are upset with him. But, you know, is that Jack Kemp first advanced the idea of enterprise zones? Reagan embraced enterprise zones, and enterprise zones were designed to create wealth and freedom and opportunity in otherwise depressed areas by creating an absence of government. And if Carrier was leaving because of the overburden of regulation and taxation, and Trump says, we're going to get rid of these regulations, these onerous regulations, we're going to reduce your tax burden and your penalties, isn't that creating an absence of government, and thus shouldn't we support it and applaud it? I know it's it's a different way of looking at things, but I think that you can still look at it through a conservative economic framework.
I confess to not understanding all of the particulars of this as much as I'd like to, but I think you're right. There's definitely a new approach here, and shaking up the deck, I think, is a desirable deal, as is a return to peace through strength. And Craig, if you were advising Donald Trump, again, informed by insights from the Reagan years and experience, what would you be commending to him in that regard?
Read his mail. Read your mail. You know, as you remember, and I do, is that no president read his mail the way Reagan did. And he would get Helene Von Damme and the other secretaries, the other gals there, would bring Reagan about 10, 15 letters every day. So instead of reading the New York Times and, you know, moaning about a column by Maureen Dowd, he's reading letters from people who are applauding him, people who are denouncing him, and people who are really hurting. And every one of those people got a handwritten note from Ronald Reagan. But he had a special insight into this country, into the American people, and why he was president and what it meant to be president by reading his mail from the constituents of the president of the United States instead of reading the trash of the elites. And I think he always kept himself open and apart and distinct from the elites, in part because he was always the quintessential American, because he was always in touch with the quintessential American.
Let me close with a final question, which goes back to our beginning conversation. We touched on it, but I want to conclude on this 75th anniversary with your final thoughts on what was done to Admiral Husband Kimmel and Lieutenant General Walter Short, and why really it behooves President Obama to pardon and rehabilitate these two fine men, and if not him, Donald Trump.
They need it. They deserve it. It's been 75 years in the making. They were cashiered for all the wrong reasons. They were as much a victim of December 7th as was the soldiers and sailors who were there at Oahu on December 7th, as much as the U.S. country was, as much as the government was, is that they were not given all the information that the government had so that they could properly prepare, they could make preparations, they could formulate their own opinions. These were two well thought of, highly regarded military career officers, three-star admiral and a three-star general. Both who lost stars and both who were out of the military by 1942, both who died really broken men, tragically scapegoated for no reason whatsoever other than the blame was either going to go to the politicians in Washington, the War Department, or it was going to go to Kimmel and Short. And Kimmel and Short had no idea about the ways of Washington and how to manipulate the press and the columnists and public attitudes so that they ended up being unfairly scapegoated.
Craig Shirley, you are one of those who've written the history that makes clear they were innocent of the charges leveled against them. I thank you for doing it, as well as for all of these terrific contributions to our understanding of Reagan and the challenges of our time, past, present, and to come. I hope you will keep it up and that you will come back to us again very soon. And thank you for spending this full hour with us on the occasion of the 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.